Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Daniel Lacalle and Ira Harris. Daniel holds a PhD in economics and is chief economist at Tresis, has been ranked in the top 20 most influential economists in the world. He's the author of several books, including most recently Escape from the Central Bank Trap and Freedom or Equality. Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Well, thank you very much. Great pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Richard.
Great. I thought we'd begin with a discussion on the European Central Bank. Daniel, what do you make of your thoughts on their move to a more rigid yield curve control policy? Is this intended to reduce the burden of debt through financial repression? What are your thoughts?
Yes, I think that what the European Central Bank is moving into is trying to do yield curve control, because they've basically exhausted all other tools. No, you look at the European Central Bank's policies in the last 5 years: negative rates done, massive quantitative easing done, direct repurchase of both investment grade bonds and government assets done. So basically the European Central Bank finds itself stuck between a rock and a hard place. On the one side, it cannot normalize policy, because what you would see is that, as you saw in the past 2 weeks, is that the slightest move in sovereign bond yields can generate a very big impact on the landscape, both of the economy and markets. Is that bond yields, sovereign bond yields, are so massively and artificially depressed that the slightest move creates a big problem. So it's caught in that situation. The ECB right now is more than 100% of sovereign bonds net issuances, and that means that there is no market. So so what they're trying now to do is to manage the curve in order to avoid inflationary pressures generating a slump in equity and bond markets.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I think Daniel's points are very well taken, and it's, you know, the European view, which is, I was watching yesterday, so as long as we're talking about Europe, we have Lagarde, who is certainly reading Powell are certainly locked arm in arm, along with Yellen. You know, they have Yellen too, and there's a relationship between, of course, Lagarde and Yellen for years. So they're all pushing the same. And I think that, you know, because of the nature of the European bond market, it being for the ECB anyway, 19 variables, because they have so many different bonds that they buy to meet the requirements that they've set for themselves with their quantitative easing, they're really doing yield curve control, because even Lagarde keeps talking about that, well, on a day-to-day basis, it's not an issue of really a capital key, because they'll override it if they need to, if certain countries' bonds may be under pressure. They're not going to tell you how much they're buying, and they'll violate the capital key. And that's an issue of flows. That's what Draghi used to talk about. Yes, flows versus stock. At the end of a period of time, they'll smooth it out, and they'll always, quote unquote, always adhere to the capital key. But the United States has a more difficult role, because they can't surreptitiously do yield curve control. They're going to have to tell the market that they're doing yield curve control. And of course, we saw some of that yesterday, but I'm sure we'll talk more about that as it evolves. But in following up with Daniel, last week we saw the elections out of Germany,
mm-hmm.
or over the weekend. And interestingly, that the official Monetary Financial Institutions Forum, which was, I think, put together by David Marsh, who is, I mean, back in the 90s, I read his book on the Bundesbank, which was really enlightening for me and is really knowledgeable. But even he had a piece out on, what's the date? I've been in Chicago moving. Okay, so it must have been Monday after the elections. And he had a piece out, heavy losses for Merkel complicate European recovery policies. And that makes it even much more difficult because, as he cites, you know, there's more court cases coming. The Germans are not happy. They are not happy. They are suffering. And we're on the Financial Repression Authority. They are truly suffering. Probably the worst case right now in the world of financial repression, because it appears that by any measure, inflation is probably in Germany, certainly over a two handle, even though throughout Europe itself, it's not. So with negative, where are we at on the Euribor this morning? Negative 75, I'm sorry, negative 52 basis points. So they're only being financially repressed to the tune of about a negative 3% real yield, which is causing political uncertainty. You know, it's not just the COVID vaccines. It's a lot of things. So everything that Daniel talks about, I think, is really in play here when it comes to Europe.
What do you make of the European elections, Daniel, like in the, I think the Netherlands also and Germany? What are the effects on the European economy and the financial markets do you see?
Well, I think that the German elections show that it's a much more unstable political environment in Germany than what we tend to see in the media. It's going to be very, very difficult for the CDU, the German right, center-right party, to overcome this this loss. And what we're seeing at the same time is that a fragile coalition of the left-wing parties would create a lot more instability, particularly on important areas of the German economy. We must remember that Germany implemented one of the most aggressive energy transition policies ever seen in history. It's called the Energiewende, which is which basically erased the nuclear power out of the energy mix to substitute it with renewables. And the result has been pretty phenomenal in terms of negative effect for consumers. In that sense, what we have seen is that Germany now depends more on Russian gas and on lignite, while at the same time, the huge subsidies have almost doubled the household bills. So I think that the situation in Germany, much more complicated than what is led to believe. I think that there's a general perception within Europe that no matter what the outcome of a general of an election in Germany, it's going to be a positive because they seem to get along in important matters, judging by the coalition between the socialist and the center right of the past. But I think it's more fragile this time. In the Netherlands, I think it's a very strong message of support to what has been called the frugal position. The position that we saw with at the beginning of the pandemic of some of the European northern economies that were quite opposed to a massive injection of liquidity and huge deficit spending as a response to the pandemic. So I think that it's going to be an interesting process because we are getting into the approval of the of the European Recovery Fund, which has not yet been implemented. And the new administration in the Netherlands is going to be quite quite vocal about doing things right and not just showering money to peripheral countries to waste on anything.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I mean, these are really important things that Daniel's bringing up because, again, it, really what he continues to come to is that this is still much more fragile. Europe is much more fragile. And I've been bullish, you know, since what I call when Wolfgang Schäuble, almost a year, May 24th last year, when he made the famous statement, and being that he's one of the grandfathers of especially German frugality and therefore EU frugality. Mm-hmm. But when he made that his own pivot away, when he talked about the need for helping those under COVID, and he said not with loans, but actually with grants, because he said in that famous comment over the weekend that if you give loans, it's like giving them stones, whereas if you give them grants, and he talked about $75 billion, and what became a far bigger number, but if you give them grants, it's far better. Giving them loans is like just piling more stones on top of them. So I thought that was an important point. And if we look at that point, that's when the euro was trading at 108, and I'm talking about to the dollar, and we had that sustained rally up to 122. And now yesterday, the euro, of course, after the Powell press conference, the euro did get back over 120 for a brief time, but it's back under pressure today. But yet, and let's see if I'm looking at the differential between the German Bund and the U.S. Treasury. So we're out almost to this morning, almost to 200 basis points, which is multi-year highs on the differential. But yet the euro still sits here comfortably at 119 to 120 without much good going on. And that's with the underreporting of some of the political uncertainties building and what could be, as I know a lot of people don't like him, but I think Ambrose Evans-Pritchard wrote a piece, talking about the dilemma for Lagarde with the bond purchases, but that the Germans, there are certain elements within Germany were coming again to the German High Court and saying that there is no mandate for the ECB to save the European Union. There's a lot more fragility, but I think it really reflects, when you look at the price of the euro, the real questions that the world has about the dollar. So this is all going to come to the surface, and I think Daniel's 100% right, and the German energy policy under Merkel is a cut-and-paste job that is just terrible. And now Germany is going to run into loggerheads with the U.S., because they're committed to Nord Stream 2, come hell or high water, whether it's really going to be needed or not. They are committed to it. Gerhard Schroeder is the linchpin, which the media seems to have always failed to mention, that he's the chairman of the Gazprom pipeline program brought in by Putin. There's a lot of issues that are on the slow boil here that the markets need to pay attention to. And Daniel raises them and calls attention to them. And I think very critical.
Yeah. No, I think that one of the things that you've just mentioned, which is the relative stability of the euro, is a very important driver here, is that I think that as long as the European Union into the Eurozone into 2021 is able to maintain the level of trade surplus that it enjoys right now, the inflow into the Eurozone of reserves is likely to maintain the euro within a very tight range relative to the US dollar. I think that That is correct. I also think that even with the, and allow me to be diplomatic by saying the absolutely disastrous vaccine rollout of the European Union, this is a complete nightmare what is happening here. Even with that, there's going to be a recovery, and there's going to be an estimated 4% GDP growth in the Eurozone. So all of that is going to likely maintain the euro relatively stable, unless, and I don't think it's a probability, at least in the near future, unless we started to see messages about breaking up the euro or things like that I don't think are in the political debate right now, even in countries like Italy. No.
Let me just I think that's such a great point, and we haven't even discussed the importance of Draghi.
Yeah, huge,
right? Because I look at it and people say, well, look at the narrowing of the German-Italian 10-year differentials. And yeah. I said, well, that's because Draghi will get to me, and Daniel, please correct me or let me know if you disagree, but Draghi will get whatever he wants for Italy because he knows where all the skeletons are. And it's hard to say no to him.
Oh, completely. But there's another very important point. Absolutely agree with you, Ira. Draghi is coming to power in a moment in which he has 90% of the structural reforms that the European Commission would demand already in place. The Italian economy is already in a trade surplus. There's a primary surplus in the economy. The pension reform has already been implemented, and the administration reform has already been implemented. So Draghi only has to do one little thing, and I say this from Madrid, Spain, is he only has to point slightly, a little bit further to Spain to look really good, huh? Because things in Spain are a complete shambles. So the only thing that he needs to do is to present himself as a reformer, because the reforms have already been implemented, so he doesn't have to spend political capital in things like pensions and things like administration. And the only thing that he needs to do is to spend a lot of money wisely. And I think that is what he is going to aim for. And I think that that and presenting Italy as the positive example of a recovery relative to, for example, Spain is going to be a huge element of his, let's say, approach towards the rest of the Eurozone.
Oh, wow. I wrote that down. Spend a lot of money wisely. That is a great line. I am going to use it in the blog because that is so... Absolutely, because he'll get whatever he wants.
Yeah.
It's like I said to somebody, I dare anybody in Europe to tell Draghi no. He buried most of the bodies, so he certainly knows where they're all buried.
Absolutely. He knows the system. He knows how the European Commission works. He knows how the European Central Bank moves. And more importantly, he comes to a country that has been so tired of a coalition that was an absolute nightmare. We only see headlines, bits and pieces here and there, but people in Italy that had to endure day by day nonsense from Cinque Stelle and from the from Mr. Salvini. I mean, whatever. They want somebody that is going to put some money to work. Italy did something from the very beginning of this recovery fund process that was critical, is that they appointed an independent commission of entrepreneurs and business leaders to channel and to make the requests of these funds. So they're going to be not just at the forefront, but they're going to be at the forefront with projects that at least in paper make economic sense.
Yeah, it's you know what? Italy has done very little right. If I'm going to go back to, when they used to change leadership every 6 months.
They continue to do that.
But you know what? At least Mario Monti, which was a plague from Brussels on the Italian people because he was pathetic. I understood it was like in the United States with anybody but Trump, anybody but Berlusconi. and they squeezed him out. Well, Mario Monti was a disaster. But Mario Draghi comes knowing full well how all this works. And there will be no say no to Italy. Actually, yeah, Italy looks pretty good. And as much as I detest the Italian banks and all European banks, but you got to look at it and go, no, this was really a brilliant move on the part of the Italians. I really, and even Five Star, they saw the intelligence of this because, hey, it's now open up the floodgates because we're going to get I think Italy comes. I mean, France really moves. It's interesting. You look at Spain, I look at Italy and go, or France and go, under Macron, they're really at a loss here. Macron doesn't think so because, of course, he thinks that he's Charles de Gaulle's reincarnation or his illegitimate child. But, you know, he really thinks he's Charles de Gaulle. But they're adrift here. And now they're gonna get into what we would call here in the United States a pissing match with the Chinese. I don't think that's a very good role to play. But the Italians really have been elevated here.
No, I completely agree. And I think that comparison relative to two very, very important economies in the Eurozone, France and Spain, is going to make Mario Draghi's position a lot easier. I completely agree.
Just coming back to the German approach to energy, Daniel, that you mentioned earlier, do you see energy commodity prices going higher from agenda-based or government-based environmentalist policies, maybe towards adversely affecting fossil fuel production and supply chain?
I genuinely think that we will continue to see some strength in energy commodities. There have been short and long-term effects leading to where we are right now. The longer term effects have been the underinvestment that actually we did discuss another time in this chat. No, is the underinvestment that has been going in the energy sector for a few years now. I'm talking since 2014. The other is obviously the base effect. You know, just we've gone from a slump in demand to a rapid recovery in demand that is not easily met by supply. And environmental policies do have an impact, but I think it's more of a long-term one. You have one is efficiency, which obviously efficiency is eroding an entire Sweden of demand every year. And technology disinflation is there as well. But I think that at least until mid-year 2021, we are likely to continue to have strength in energy commodities coming from the supply challenges or the supply management coming from OPEC. Both things work. And the recovery in demand, while some of the supply chains that you mentioned have been severely compromised. So I think that is likely to happen. The problem, I think, comes in the second part of the year. The second part of the year, I think that you can have a drastic move down as supply starts to kick in and estimates of global demand growth start to be at least trimmed.
Your thoughts, Ira?
There's nothing I disagree with there. So I think that there's a lot of truth. You'll see that, as Daniel points out, the investment really returned. Like in the United States, it's been a lot of investment pulled back from the fracking because it was just ill thought out, and it supported a lot of production that wound up actually impinging upon prices. So I think that lenders into that sector are going to be much more reticent. And I think, and this is one of the things, and we talked about it quite a bit over time, Richard, is that so much of the analysis is so static. You know, it's like when I read the Mideast foreign policy coming out of the Biden group, it's appalling. Because they think they're going to have their way with everybody. Oh, we're going to come down hard on the Saudis. Well, the Saudis are not going to sit there and take this. We saw this. The world changed dramatically in 2016 in the fall when the Saudi king went to Moscow.
Yeah.
The world changed dramatically. And I read from these foreign policy people who are in the Biden group, and you know what? I gag on it because it's so static that I go, you think the world is going to wait for you? You think you're just sanctioned the Saudis and the Saudis are going to go, oh, yeah, thank you, sir. May I have another? The world is not they're not going to react like that. Your models are static, just like the Fed models. Mm-hmm. It's all static. You better change your tune because the world is a far more dynamic place. And the Saudis and the Russians will do more to affect energy one way or another. We've seen it both ways, by the way.
Yeah.
The Chinese are certainly a big player. We in the West are busy, and this goes to Europe too, bashing the Chinese over what goes on in Xinjiang with the Uyghurs. And morally, that's right. We don't know exactly what's happening there. But, and there, who's one of the biggest customers of Iranian oil? The Chinese. Hmm. Well, there are a lot of things that don't connect very well, because if the Islamic issue was such a big issue, why are the Iranians doing so much business with the Chinese? And because it's always the Iranians who are projecting themselves as the linchpin of the Islamic world. And I think that's what scares the Saudis more than anything. Is because in order to be the linchpin of the Islamic world, you got to have control over Mecca and Medina. And last I looked on my map, that's in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's be very careful here. And I have no time for everybody's static analysis. I'd get a little bit more dynamic. I missed the passing of Zygmunt Brzezinski, who I've had my differences since I've been in graduate school going back, what year is this? So 40, some 45 years ago when I was reading Brzezinski, not necessarily on foreign policy, but on other things, totalitarianism. But Brzezinski really had laid a lot of this out, and his recent work before he died was so good at understanding what the Russians were doing. And he was, Brzezinski was really critical of the West in many ways, in the way that they were approaching Russia and with the way they were, thinking that, hey, this is still a containment world. The containment world is over, even though I know the Atlantic group put out a new longer telegram, which was kind of interesting piece in regards to China. So world is far more dynamic.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And I think that you've touched upon a very important thing, which is I think that the West was extremely paternalistic and extremely confident that the OPEC Plus agreement would not work and that it would just fall apart at the seams. And here we are, a few years later, and it's working. So I think that as consumer nations, and it's one thing that in the Eurozone, they don't pay any attention to, and probably in many of the consumer nations as well. One of the things that we need to think about is that the dynamic at in the producing countries is changing significantly, and they're starting to realize that there has been a shift in which they have gone from being price takers and suffering the brunt of the slowdown in the economy to taking advantage of this supply chain challenges that we have seen. So I would pay a lot of attention to that. I think that it's very, very interesting to see how that OPEC Plus agreement has lasted far longer and remains much stronger than what most political commentators expected.
Yeah, and that's right. Anytime anybody wants to ramp up, listen, we saw that the Obama administration made a critical error by allowing the Russians back into the Mideast.
Mm-hmm.
With the debacle about red lines. It was a debacle, and it allowed the Russians to reestablish that port in the Mediterranean. In the Eastern Mediterranean, and has given them a foothold, and they're even dealing with the Turks. The Turks buying Russian buying air defense systems from Russia. There are so many moving parts here, and yet all the analysis we read is so friggin' static, and yet that's how people invest on that static. Many, many moving parts here. This is not going to be as easy. You know, we already see it with China, because anytime that, you know, you can lash out at China, you can beat at China. China has the tripwire of playing the Taiwan card whenever they wish. And that will really get things going. So, you know what? We keep coming to this. It comes out of Europe. But I would not be so quick to sanction everybody, because we see the sanctions are a joke anyway.
Yeah.
Yes, I know. I know the Iranian economy is far weaker. Yeah, that's true. But once you learn, you know, we learned something about Cuba, that the more we sanction Cuba, the stronger that economy, the underlying economy got, because you learn how to, what is that little quote that goes, life isn't about, you know, worrying about the rainfall. It's learning how to dance in the rain.
Yeah.
And when you keep sanctioning everybody, they eventually learn to dance in the rain, because everybody's trying to make business wherever they can anyway. So, you know, cut it out. And the more you use that weapon, the less force it really has.
Absolutely. And I think also to that point, in terms of sanctions, sanctions become a perfect justification for the existing regime to put all of the economic and social troubles of the country under the umbrella of it's because of the sanctions, and perpetuate themselves in power. And, you know, and that obviously generates even worse problems for the population.
Yeah, very good point.
Continuing on the supply chain issues, if we extend this discussion to other commodities and just global trade in general, given the supply chain disruptions due to the COVID response, Daniel, what are your thoughts on inflation? Is it a cyclical short-term thing or structural long-term, and why?
Well, the problem with inflation is that usually you have to respond both. Is that on one side, you have the reality of the disinflationary pressures coming from technology, from aging of the population, from too much debt. All those disinflationary pressures not only remain, but were accelerated throughout COVID-19 and the crisis. I think that what is different right now is that we are seeing significant inflationary pressures in non-replicable goods and services. We mentioned commodities. It's not just energy commodities. It's everything that has to do with food. Very, very important increase in prices of fresh food all over the world, particularly in emerging economies. And those are quite concerning. I think that the impact of those supply chain challenges that we talked about is relevant. I think it's more relevant to think about that the two things about inflation. No, the first thing is that we are seeing input prices in the industrial complex coming up quite rapidly. But because basically throughout the crisis, overcapacity has been perpetuated through massive loans, refinancing, you name it. What we are seeing is the inability of many industries of being able to pass those input prices to consumers. So margins are under pressure. The other element that is that a vast majority of commentators are expecting a huge increase in consumption from the reopening. Part of that may happen, but not as aggressively, precisely for what I mentioned before, is that for an average household, inflationary pressures are stronger than what headline CPI shows. I'll just briefly comment, for example, on the February Eurozone CPI that came out yesterday. No, it was 0.9%, 0.9%, you know, very subdued level of headline inflation. But if you look at the components, you would see that almost every component is up 1.5-1.6%, yet the headline CPI is brought down by a fall in of 1.7% in energy. However, the way that CPI is calculated is quite tricky, because energy is considered as the raw material, not as what you and I pay for energy. So if you include taxes and subsidies, which are huge in Europe, you don't see the reduction in energy in your basket, but you do see the increase in fresh food, in public services, in healthcare, in education, in rent, that they are significantly higher. So the point is, yes, we are seeing inflationary pressures. Those will continue, and particularly in those non-replicable goods and services. I think that what we are also likely to see is that headline and official inflation will come down from the levels it will reach in June because of the base effect. The base effect works both ways, no?
Yep. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, Daniel, I don't have to worry about them, because both Lagarde and Powell have told me, don't worry, it's transitory and it's just based on the way that we calculate. So as the deflationary forces from last year drop out of our equations, of course it's going to, but that's transitory. So we've been told, don't worry about it. They all know, they know that this inflation doesn't matter. But Daniel brings up a point that is eating at me. I'm going to put it in that term, Daniel. And I've talked about it, Richard. I think we talked about it last time with maybe with the four horsemen of the apocalypse. But a keystone for me, Daniel, is to watch the Chinese yuan.
Yeah.
And as the yuan goes higher, I make that more inflationary on the rest of the world.
It is.
And here's something that the Fed, because their models are devoid of international money flows, and you know, I have argued for 45 years since I've been in graduate school that the Phillips curve was flawed because it didn't have a global component.
Yeah.
We looked at the domestic impact of wages, you know, jobs and wages, and I said, well, and then certainly after 1989, when the world changed dramatically, the Berlin Wall falls, the Chinese are in full force. And then 1994, they depreciate the yuan by 50% to take them to the next step. But there's no component, that once you unleash this global labor force of literally a few billion from Eastern Europe through Asia, with the Chinese leading the way, and of course all the Asian tigers, you had downward pressure on wages that were never picked up by the curve. But that's so you had, but with the advent of China, China allowed the central banks to believe that they were, and I'm not talking about the BOJ, the Japanese were suffering true deflation, but there's no other country in the world who has suffered deflation, even if we've gone on the march of quantitative ease. It was all in the anticipation of heading off deflation, right? This was classic Bernanke, his work in the 30s, and especially 1937. But we never got to that deflation. But there were, as Paul says, disinflationary forces. Well, the key disinflationary force in the world was, of course, China, with its huge amount of capacity that it brought onto the world and kept prices down, especially wages, more than controlled. They were downward pressure on wages, which is why you've had the inequality. And that was actually captured very well. Sorry, Daniel, but by Thomas Piketty.
Yeah.
With R being greater than G. I mean, to simplify it, what Piketty was, he saw it in its full exposure. So we've had all of that. And that was the Chinese. But when I watched yuan, because I've watched commodity prices defy economic reality, according to many sources, as we've seen over, especially over the last 8 months, after the what I would call the March-April dip of 2020, when commodity prices and I'll use the Bloomberg Commodity Index in this regard, dropped dramatically. We've seen quite a rebound, and yet the global economy has not nearly been in step with what prices are. But at the same time, the yuan has been rallying, strengthening, let me put it in that way. The yuan has been strengthening. So that told me, or I perceive and conjecture, therefore, that somebody's been stockpiling a lot of raw materials.
Yeah.
And that somebody has to be China, because and it's interesting, because I've been I sold my house. I'm busy packing, or I was. I'm back in Arizona now, but I just came back. But I found an old magazine that I had kept from June of 2007, the Far Eastern Economic Review, which is really a very good journal. And I kept it because my son had a book review in here about Japan. He's a Japan expert. But the cover story, the lead story, this is from June of 2007, China's Last Option, Let the Yuan Soar. And it was written by one of my favorite economists. I don't know how you feel about him, Michael Pettis, who I think is one of the smartest and most intelligent sources on China. So I'm looking at it, and if China is doing what I think they're doing, which is what Pettis has advised for years and years and years, which is shifting to a much more domestic consumption-based economy than an export. Not that they're still not major exporters. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
But if you want to enrich your middle class, you want your currency to appreciate, because then all the things you need to buy to sustain your middle-class consumer, you import.
Yeah.
Well, a stronger currency, as Germany will certainly show us, keeps prices under control and enriches your middle class. So if this scenario, if this conjecture is right, I think the yuan is going to go test. We're at 6.50 today. I think we will go to 6.25 to test that, and we'll I don't forecast time periods. But I think we'll go and we'll test that January 1st, 1994 level of 5.8. That will be a critical test. But this will all be done with China pivoting to a more domestic consumption. And that will bring to bear a major rise in global prices because the Chinese will not be flooding the global system with its excess capacity. It'll be using it to aid and abet its own middle class further development.
That is a great, great, great point. I would add to it, which I completely agree with, I would add to it that Chinese official unemployment is at 5.5%. Youth unemployment is 13%. So there's one thing that China cannot do right now is to aim at constantly depreciating the currency. What they need to do is to strengthen disposable income. And the only way in which you, after a recovery like the one that China has had in 2020 and expected in 2021, the only way in which you bring that level of unemployment to 3 and 10 is with internal consumption, is by boosting internal demand significantly. Because, as you know, I read in a report about China that 60% of small and medium enterprises in China are working at 60% capacity. So basically what you need to do is get the consumer internally to buy from the small and medium enterprises and that will boost job creation. And obviously you cannot do that by going constantly down the Argentina way of depreciating the currency. So I think that that is an interesting factor because globally, central banks look at disinflationary pressures using their perception of what is going to come from imported goods and services. But if imported goods and services start to go up in price, then there's a significant inflationary pressure that we had not been thinking about in the past 5 years.
Yes. You know what? And when I listen to Powell tell me that the disinflationary forces will contain, he didn't say this yesterday, interestingly, but he is, you know, when he testified before Congress and he's speaking probably right now, I think 11 o'clock Eastern time. So these disinflationary forces. Now, I know that India exists out there and that will come to play, but it's not here now. And you are going to get blindsided if you think that in your limited modeling that the same global disinflationary forces are going to be at play here. I would be very careful and I think some of what the action in the bond market is telling you that, you know, we haven't gotten to that discussion. So I'll await that because we want to discuss the Fed and where they're going there. But I think that point, Daniel, is I think this is a very important theme that is going to play out.
Yeah, in terms of central bank policies from a major central bank point of view, Daniel, do you think or what are your views on a financial system that is structurally levered to support appreciated asset prices? Is that more important to central bank policies than containing inflation?
Oh, certainly it is. You know, central banks always do the same thing. No, first they say that there's no inflation, then they say that it's transitory, and then they say that it's because of the evil decisions of business owners or of the Chinese. So don't worry about that. And as Ira was saying, both Lagarde and Powell have told me not to worry, so I shouldn't joke. But I think that central bank policy right now is impossible to change. And the reason why it's impossible to change is because we have already seen what it was called the rate tantrum, which is not even the rate hangover, show how little capacity does the average central bank have to accept that in a rising GDP growth with normalized rise in inflation, bond yields are going to rise, no? Which shows how structurally leveraged to the theme of low inflation, high liquidity, low rates, the market is, no? Mm-hmm. So I think that central banks will pay a lot more attention to bond yields and to the response from markets rather than the creeping rising prices that we see.
Any other thoughts, Ira?
I agree. And they're always pointing at somebody. But now that the market is, you know, and again, Powell does not want to admit it, but he's up against it, because when you have Buffett and Dalio and Druckenmiller and Gundlach and on and on and Kovner and some of the great global macro titans going, hey, the bonds are not just, they're a mal investment. And now I'm with Rosenberg with you, Richard, and who I respect immensely, and I'm great. And he's been right for a long time. But we are now hitting a point in the same way I feel about Lacey Hunt, one of the great bond minds ever. He's just great. In the way he approaches bond market. But right now the market is calling a lot of these people out, and there's some people sitting on some very ugly returns, by the way. There's nothing free here. And I will add to this that, you know, the Fed's pretty smug here, thinking that they're going to control this, especially because one of the big players, you know, everybody's talking about the convexity trades, and those are, of course, significantly important, and we have that going on. But part of the convexity world, of course, is those who have to hedge their bond portfolio exposure. Well, we know that the world's largest single bondholder, meaning the Fed balance sheet, they don't hedge. So the bonds are doing what they're doing with one of the most dynamic players, or potentially, well, now they've become static, but one of the greatest dynamic missing from the marketplace. So if I'm in the Fed, I'm even more worried, because I don't play in this arena, and yet they're pushing at it pretty good. So the market's trying to force the Fed's hand with yield curve control. We're going back to 1946 to 1951. I don't see a way around it. Or what the market is going to do, and we'll find out. And Steve Leisman really was on top of this and asked a question. Of course, Powell danced it as good as Mario Draghi ever danced a question. So he must have been taking magician lessons from Mario. But they will push the market to, as I was talking with somebody this morning, to a level that reflect historical real rates of return on long-term debt. So it used to be, you know, for years and years, that if the 10-year yielded a real rate of return, so not nominal rates, but real rates of positive 2%, that would take us to the 10-year to about, I'm going to use the Fed numbers, to 3.5% to 4% in order to get those levels. And if the Fed's not going to do anything to stop it, watch what the market does to demand what they're going to want for return on all this borrowing being done by sovereign governments.
Mm-hmm. Completely agree, yeah.
Just a final question on cryptocurrencies and central bank digital currencies. You mentioned recently to beware of CBDCs. Daniel, can you elaborate on that? And do you see the allowance or governments to allow private-based cryptocurrencies to coexist alongside government-based cryptocurrencies?
Well, the idea, well, the project of digital currencies from central banks is going to be going, and it's going to be moving forward no matter what. Mm-hmm. I think that it, in any case, misses the point. And it misses the point because the idea behind these central bank digital currencies is to increase the level of control that the central bank has on transactions, and it's also a way to try to compete with cryptocurrencies. But I don't think that one asset has anything to do with the other. The citizens all over the world that look for cryptocurrencies are basically looking for an asset that that goes up more than inflation and that reduces the risk of losing purchasing power of their own currency. For us, either in the Eurozone or in the United States or in Canada, we see cryptocurrencies as a volatile and as a and as a financial asset. But think about it from the perspective of an Argentine citizen that has seen the Argentine peso lose 98% of its purchasing power in the last 10 years relative to the US dollar, or the Brazilian real or the Mexican peso or so many currencies out there. I think that it's very, very difficult to believe that any of those central banks in those countries are going to generate any incremental demand for their currency by going digital. In the case of the European Union, of the Eurozone and the United States, the project to implement the digital currency is unstoppable. I think it's completely unstoppable because I think that there are two elements there. One is what Ira was mentioning before, is to try to prevent China from making the yuan a world reserve currency. The second is obviously to try to compete with cryptocurrencies within the market. And I think that in any case, governments and central banks, they like the monopoly of creating money. They don't like competition there, and they will try to do anything to stop the stop cryptocurrencies, independent cryptocurrencies, from becoming a generalized mean of payment.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Bingo. I agree totally. Yeah. And see, I think that the Chinese, you know, I don't know where Dan, maybe we talked about it last time, but when the Chinese come with their crypto, which is also an answer to the silliness of sanctions, by the way. Yes, I understand the SWIFT system and I understand the U.S. ability, but as people don't sit there and say, you know, yeah, oh yeah, the United States wants this, I'm just going to wait for you. World doesn't work that way. Never has. So they're looking for ways around it. Now, if I'm an oligarch or I'm a Chinese extremely wealthy person and I'm trying to circumvent some of the things that they're sanctioning for, I'm going to put some money into crypto, right? And it's more because of the blockchain. But Daniel is right, and I'll say it. It says it in the U.S. Constitution, and every government in the world throughout history does not like competition when it comes to their currency. That's the act of a sovereign. Now, in forming the euro, well, the Germans thought it was going to be, of course, a Deutschmark, and everybody else thought it was going to be a French franc or a lira. I won't say the French franc because under Trichet, the policy of Le Fort Franc was squeezed the hell out of the French middle class, but what they thought it would be an Italian lira or a Spanish peseta. So there's always been a difference. But when you surrendered that sovereignty, which you did by becoming part of the euro, well, they did it backwards, of course, because you're supposed to have a harmonized fiscal policy, but they figured that wouldn't go well. So they did the currency first and put it in everybody's hand, kind of force everybody into that situation. But you do not like competition. That's my only problem with a Bitcoin. We will be in a world of some type of cryptocurrency. But if the Chinese are truly looking for reserve status, they will make it backed by gold and silver. Silver would be a a payback for, of course, the opium wars and Britain's efforts to depreciate and devalue the Chinese economy, because the Chinese economy was based on silver. So we know what took place. So if the Chinese come up with a crypto, make it somewhat backed by gold and silver, and they will gain immediate international status. Now, it doesn't have to be one-to-one like the, you know, you set it on some, in today's world, if you did it probably, if it was 10% backed by a precious metal, everybody in the world would desire it, because at least it would have something behind it besides ink. I agree with that. Because the U.S. Constitution says that Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 5, about the role of the U.S. government when it comes to currency.
Mm-hmm.
So it's here, and it's here for a reason, because of mistakes that are being made, I think, regularly. I think Daniel absolutely is right about that, and how we see it finish play out, I don't know. But it won't be an SDR. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
It's been great insight and discussion. Gentlemen, how can our listeners learn more about your work, Daniel?
Oh, well, you can find me on Twitter. It's at DLACALLE_IA. You can find me on my YouTube channel, Daniel Lacalle in English, or you can find me in my website. It's not difficult to find me. Just write Daniel Lacalle and you'll be bombarded by boredom.
So, that's not true. I go to his YouTubes. Very good.
Yeah. And Ira.
Well, I'm still, I haven't written, but I'm hoping to write tonight. This will get me going, Notes from Underground. And I'm doing, again, a lot of podcasts with you, Richard, and of course, Anthony Credelli, and I go on White Wave, and I go to the PAX group. So where I sit in chat rooms, which are really good, we get to hash out and thrash out good investable ideas, because again, I think what Daniel and I both bring is we bring actionable ideas. And I'm just so enamored with the line from the Deng Xiaoping administration and the way that Deng moved China off of Maoism, which was to use this as the measure. Practice is the sole criterion for judging truth. That's me. That's what I strive to do, to make everything actionable and not just gibberish theoretical, to put theory to practice. And if we do it well, we'll find very profitable investments.
Yes, exactly. Words of wisdom. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you, Daniel and Ira.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure. Have a great
Daniel,
day.
Daniel, this was great. You know, we really thrashed out some ideas. I got to go back to think about some things, and thank you for the opportunity. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah. Pleasure for me. Same here. Have a great day.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Take care.